Stony Brook. He's been speaking at this conference for 20 years. Emergency physician. And he's gone over GI bleeding. And I still have more questions for Cheryl Lee.
All right, so I'm sorry we're a little bit behind here, and I'll try to move fast, but if we don't cover everything, that's okay. But interesting, think about how much of our conference is dedicated to problems with either too much bleeding or too little bleeding, too much thrombosis, too little thrombosis. So really a lot of our life is spent around either stopping clotting formation or stopping bleeding. So we're going to talk about upper GI bleeds. If you have questions, ask me. But we're going to try to go pretty fast if we can get this going. So here's your first patient. She's 56-year-old. She vomited a cup full of bright red blood. She drinks 6 beers daily. She's had no prior episodes of GI bleed. And her vital signs are a little tachycardic. She's anxious. She has no rectal blood. And her hemoglobin is 11. So what do you want to do with her? Okay. So some of the questions that we're going to try to answer is, does this patient require IV fluids? If you're giving fluids, what type of fluids should you give? How fast should you give it? Does she need to be transfused? Yes or no? Okay, what about nasogastric tubes? How many people still put in nasogastric tubes in GI bleeders? None of you do? Okay, all right. Should you receive PPI? Do you have to give it before they go to endoscopy or only after? What about antibiotics? Who gets antibiotics? Everybody? Everybody? Somatostatin analogs and endoscopy. The big question, are there any GI specialists here? The big question is it emergent endoscopy? Should you be bringing in these patients? So hopefully we'll try to answer some of those. And of course, we're already having problems. So, okay. So it's very common. It can be deadly, although it's less deadly than we think. Patients may present with either hematemesis or melena, which usually suggests an upper GI bleed. They may present with hematochezia, which rarely can be from upper GI bleeding, but usually those patients are very unstable. Interestingly, patients who present with melena instead of hematemesis actually do better, but they require more blood because it's delayed. Remember, usually by the time you see the melanotic stool, it's maybe a day or two after they bled. And so they tend to present later, more anemic, but the mortality is less than with hematemesis. Let's see what happens. Okay, and we're not going to talk about lower GI bleeds, which are actually less deadly. So still the most common causes of upper GI bleed in adults, and we'll focus on adults, is peptic ulcers, gastric erosions, esophagogastric varices, Mallory Weiss tears, esophagitis, and gastric cancer. So what's common is common. By the way, do you guys refer Mallory Weiss to endoscopists? You send them home? Yeah, our GI guys want to see all these patients, so I'm not sure what you need to do with them. But all right, you got to think about the mimics, of course. Not everyone who has blood coming from their mouth is bleeding from the GI tract, and this could be a potential problem. So it could be dental bleeding. It could be epistaxis. It could be ingestion of various fluids that are red, hemoptysis. Any of you, a patient comes up and they say, I'm coughing up blood, and you think it's hemoptysis. It turns out to be GI bleed. I remember we had a patient who was bleeding from the trachea and bleeding, and we got ENT, we got everything. But when we intubated the patient, it became very apparent that the blood source was not the airway, it was actually the upper GI tract. So sometimes you can get confused. Here are some other things you have to think about, certainly with hematochezia and so on. This is going to delay things. Okay, so just like everything else, chest pain, heart failure, PE, risk stratification. Who said it? Someone said, I don't remember who was here, one of our guys said, the strict risk stratification, James, I think it was, is really part of our everyday activities as emergency physicians. So we don't only want to know what the disease is. We want to know if that disease is going to cause that patient bad outcomes. Do I need to admit that patient? Do I need to get a specialist? Do they need to go to the intensive care unit? That's our questions. And so there are a number of different studies and risk scores that have been indicated or developed. And the one that's most commonly used is the Glasgow-Blatchford score. And here you see in the receiver operating characteristic curves, it looks at the area under the curve of how well does that rule or risk stratification identify the risk for bad things that happen. And you can see the closer that the curve is to the upper left corner, that would be 100% accurate. And the blue line is the Glasgow-Blatchford score. There are others, there's the ROCL, the Ames-65, but the one that's most commonly used is the Glasgow-Blatchford. And here it is. And I think that risk scores are often helpful if they're intuitive. So this seems kind of intuitive. The lower the hemoglobin, the lower the blood pressure, the higher the heart rate, the more evidence of blood, the more comorbidities. It makes sense that these patients are going to do worse. And indeed, this is how you can calculate it. Who doesn't have MDCalc on their phone? If you don't, it's the best investment. MDCalc, it has all the rules. It has this one. It has the Wells criteria. So you can calculate these. And in fact, this is one systematic review that looked at how well did the Glasgow-Blatchford score predict the need for intervention, rebleeding, and death. And in fact, if you had a score of zero, it was 99% sensitive, which is what we're looking for as emergency physicians, right? If you're a zero, you can go home, nothing's going to happen. But the specificity was pretty bad, only 8%. So the endoscopists don't really like that. Do I get extra time for this, Frank? All right. So they said, well, zero is great, but it's not specific enough. So another study of about 5,000 patients where they said, you know what, the optimal cutoff would be one. So with one, we still have a 99% sensitivity, but our specificity is a lot better. So we could actually avoid admissions in up to a quarter of the patients. So if you have a patient who comes in and their Glasgow-Blatchford score is a one or a zero, that patient generally can go home if there's nothing else wrong with them. So not all GI bleeds need to come into the hospital. Okay, so, you know, after coming here for almost 20 years, I will have to say that this year has been the one with the most problems with AV, and I'm not sure why. But I do apologize, but I don't take personal responsibility for it. Okay, so high-risk patients, obviously, patients who are on aspirin, NSAIDs, steroids, history of peptic ulcer disease, alcoholism, current smokers, all of these things, of course, are high-risk patients, and they may need to be treated a little bit differently, and forget what their Glasgow-Blatchford score is. Okay, so actually, bloody emesis is not more deadly than coffee ground emesis. Okay, so a lot of people think that, oh, it's frank blood versus coffee ground, they're going to do worse. No, that's not true. However, if they also have melena, then they are going to do worse. Okay, so what about NG tubes? So when I was a medical student and a resident, we always put down NG tubes. In fact, you never called GI if you didn't know what was on the NG tube, right? Because if it's active bleeding, they're going to come in, and if it's not, they're not going to come in. In fact, the argument was with hematochezia, you should put down an NG tube because maybe it's that small percentage that it's an upper GI bleed. So I don't know how many of you used to put in NG tubes routinely. Probably a lot. So this is one study. It was back in 2011. They looked at 600 patients, and they basically did a matching of patients who had NG tube placed and those that didn't. It wasn't a randomized trial, observational study. We don't know why the doctors chose to put some NG tubes in and some not. But basically, they showed there was no difference in the mortality. It made no difference if you did an NG tube or not. The next one, if we can get it going, is a randomized clinical trial, okay? The other one was observational, and basically what they did is they took 280 patients and they randomized them with upper GI bleeds to either putting in an NG tube or not putting in an NG tube, and they looked at the ability of physicians to predict ongoing bleeding before and after the NG tube, and again, it didn't make a difference. And NG tubes are very painful, and it often fails. So there's really no evidence to use NG tubes, okay? Your GI specialist may ask for it, but especially if they're going to go to early endoscopy, there's no benefit. Maybe I'll just stick up here. We'll see how this goes. Okay, so obviously initial resuscitation of all these patients, ABCs. Certainly some of these patients need to be intubated. We do get our endoscopists to come down a lot on the really sick patients, and they're very happy when the patient's intubated, so we will do that. Two large bore IVs, monitoring. Certainly the presence of hypotension is very significant. In fact, it increases the risk of death by about 10 times. So those hypotensive patients, you need to get on them really, really, really quickly. Now, there is no randomized trial of GI bleeds to look at what's the most appropriate fluid approach, but at least from trauma, and Dr. Biff will talk about this probably later, restrictive fluids is probably a better approach in general. And of course, the fluid of choice in people who are bleeding is blood, right? So what type of intravenous fluid? Again, there's a lot of studies that have compared crystalloids and colloids. I think it's been answered multiple times in various patient populations that crystalloids are just as good. There's some probably fairly flawed studies that were published in the New England Journal of Medicine from Vanderbilt, which suggested that balanced crystalloids were better than saline. So we usually go with that. But the extrapolation to upper GI bleeds is not clear. In terms of transfusions, I remember when I was a medical student, again, we used a hemoglobin of 10. Anyone below a hemoglobin of 10 would get transfused. Then the AIDS came out and people got scared about giving blood. And lots of studies were conducted in various populations, whether it's CABG patients, orthopedic patients, and even GI bleed patients, where they basically showed that a restrictive threshold of 7 or 8 grams is probably just as good as a less restrictive of 10 grams. So certainly, if the patient's hemodynamically unstable, it doesn't matter what their hemoglobin is. And in fact, the hemoglobin can lag. We know that. But if they're stable, generally, unless their hemoglobin drops below 7 or 8, we don't need to transfuse them. And again, another meta-analysis and guidelines that use 7, maybe an 8 threshold for hemoglobin if the patient has cardiac disease or has undergone orthopedic surgery. And what about patients who are taking antithrombotics? How does that affect it? I mean, we usually believe that anyone who's on antiplatelets, anticoagulants, obviously they're going to do worse, right? It may be the cause of the bleed, we think. But in fact, some studies suggest that the mortality is not increased in patients who are taking antithrombotic agents. So although it would seem intuitive that they're going to do worse, they don't always do worse. And certainly, if there's life-threatening bleeding and you're on an antiplatelet agent, you can consider giving platelets. However, some studies have suggested that giving platelets is associated with higher mortality. And that's the same also for spontaneous intracranial hemorrhages, right? There's a study that showed that if you give platelets to patients who are on antiplatelet agents who have a spontaneous bleed, their outcomes are actually worse. So a lot of times the logic makes sense, but the evidence is contrary. So in terms of anticoagulation, and I didn't mention that I do have conflict of interest because I have done consulting and speaking for Alexion, but certainly for patients who are taking warfarin, the treatment of choice is four-factor PCC. If they're having life-threatening bleeds and they're unstable, we'd like to correct the INR before doing endoscopy. A lot of, again, the GI people will insist on correcting that. If they're on warfarin, as I mentioned, the reversal agent is four-factor PCC. If they're on one of the factor 10 inhibitors, apixaban and rivaroxaban, then the reversal agent is andexanet alpha, which is a decoy molecule of factor 10A. And then if they're on dabigatran, the appropriate reversal agent in life-threatening bleeding is idarucizumab, which is praxibind, which is a monoclonal antibody against that agent. Now, interpretation of clotting problems in patients with cirrhosis is very problematic because we always think, well, they're going to be coagulopathic, they're going to bleed because they don't make factors, clotting factors. But don't forget, they also might not make anti-clotting factors like protein S and protein C. So many people talk about this balanced coagulopathy. So you really can't predict, based on your standard testing, whether or not they're going to have more bleeding or more clotting. Maybe viscoelastic studies might be more helpful, but even then, it's unclear if those can help predict what's going to be happening with the patient. So in terms of transfusing these patients with platelets, at least we use kind of a threshold of 50,000 because there is evidence that suggests when your platelet counts are very low, below 50,000, you're unable to generate thrombin. And there is a connection between platelets and the clotting factors, and thrombin and platelets function together to cease bleeding. So if the platelet count is low enough, you can't generate thrombin, and therefore the recommendation is generally to give platelets to cirrhotic patients who are bleeding if their thrombocytopenia is less than 50,000. What about PPIs? How many of you give PPIs routinely for upper GI bleeds before endoscopy? Okay, most of us do, and most of our colleagues, the GI colleagues, will be very upset if we don't. But there's really little evidence that it makes a difference if you start it before or after endoscopy. This is a meta-analysis of our six randomized clinical trials over 2,000 patients, and they showed that use of PPIs prior to endoscopy reduced the risk of high stigmata of bleeding, but not surgery or death. In other words, if you start it, you might be less likely, before endoscopy, you'll be less likely to find signs of serious bleeding that you need to intervene during endoscopy, which could be a good thing, but it doesn't affect mortality. So what we do start them on it, but I don't think it's as crucial as people think. Interestingly, the dose is similar for some of the agents. It's the 80 milligram bolus followed by 8 milligrams per hour. But there are studies that show that actually intermittent boluses is just as good as continuous IV. So whatever is more convenient for you. But I think most people usually start with a bolus and then continuous IV. How many of you are giving intermittent boluses? Anybody? So you can. It really depends a lot on your nursing staff. The other thing is, before they go to endoscopy, we'd like to empty out the stomach. And that was one of the arguments for putting down an NG tube, is that you would empty out the stomach, and it would be easier for the endoscopist to see whether there's active bleeding or not. There is some evidence that if you give erythromycin, which is a prokinetic agent, you give 250 milligrams IV about half an hour to 2 hours before endoscopy, you actually can improve visualization. How do we know that? Because there's less of a risk of having to go back a second time. Because sometimes if the GI guys go in and there's a lot of blood and they can't see a lot, they may have to go back again. So it does reduce length of stay in the hospital and need. So we do give erythromycin to these patients. TXA. Love it or leave it. How many people love TXA and use it on every bleeding patient? We had a patient the other day who came in, who was on a bunch of anticoagulants, antiplatelet agents, and had severe hematuria. Should you be injecting TXA into the bladder? So most of you, do you use it for trauma? Who uses TXA for trauma patients within the first 3 hours? Okay, who uses it for after obstetric bleeding? Not a lot of us maybe see that. How many people use it with GI bleeding? No hands up? No hands up. Okay. So, of course, TXA is an analog of lysine, which is an important amino acid in the process of activating plasminogen and fibrinolysis. And so, initially, there was a meta-analysis which suggested reduced mortality with TXA, but, of course, it was poor quality, and it was unclear if it actually worked or it didn't work. In this particular meta-analysis, which was done several years ago, it was shown that immediate treatment improved survival. And survival, in fact, fell by 10% every 15 minutes, so it looked pretty helpful. And then, of course, another systematic review came out recently before the HALTED trial, which is the main randomized clinical trial, again suggesting that mortality was reduced in patients who got TXA. And so it was pretty much accepted that you should give TXA. But then the HALTED trial came out, which was the largest randomized clinical trial of over 12,000 patients with upper GI bleeding, mostly 89% of the cases. And in fact, interestingly, about half of the cases were suspected to be variceal bleeding, which of course is one that we fear the most. And they were randomized to either a gram of TXA over 10 minutes followed by an infusion or not. And basically what they showed is the TXA did not reduce death. So after all of these smaller studies and these large meta-analysis suggesting that it worked. The big trial came out and said, no, it doesn't work. Some people haven't given up hope and have done more meta-analysis now, including the whole trial, and it now it looks like maybe it still helps. Yes?
So you're saying it didn't work for death, but were there any other endpoints, less blood, less time in the ICU, anything like that?
Yeah, it probably didn't. It really didn't have any benefit. And so at least the guys at the end of the whole trial, they suggested that if you're going to use it, you should only use it as part of a randomized clinical trial, which is what people are saying now for almost all the therapies for like for COVID also. Like, you know, oh, it didn't really work, but we don't want to give a hope. So if you still want to give it, give it, but probably under a randomized clinical trial. So it's hard for people to give up. It's hard to make people give up. On the other hand, what's the downside? Certainly if you have a patient who's bleeding to death and it's like, well, it may work, maybe it won't work. We probably don't think it causes thrombosis. So people still often use these therapies, but usually they're time dependent. And in the trauma setting, of course, if you give it within the first 3 hours, it was helpful. If you give it later, it's not. So timing, the problem is we also wait for these Hail Marys. You know, they've been there forever, and nothing's getting better, and then you finally say, well, let's just add this. But by the time you make that decision, it's probably it's not effective. Then people came up with the idea of, why don't we give the TXA locally, right? We'll put down an NG tube, we'll give the TXA locally. They did a study, no benefit. So both intravenous, systematic or systemic, as well as topical therapies did not work. Timing of endoscopy, as I said, is a real problem because as far as we're concerned, it can't be soon enough. And as far as the endoscopists are concerned, it can't be late enough. So they don't like to come in unless the patient is stabilized. But sometimes the only way to stabilize the patient is to do endoscopy. So you're really between a rock and a hard place here. And so their recommendations, at least their guidelines, generally say that most patients should undergo endoscopy within 24 hours after appropriate resuscitation. However, certainly patients with higher risk features like very high Glasgow Blatchford scores or ongoing bleeding and hypotension, tachycardia, cirrhosis, they may need earlier endoscopy. So where's the evidence? This is one of the highly quoted studies. It's an observational study in Denmark with over 12,000 patients. And you can see that curve where if you went in too early, they had higher mortality. If you went in between 6 and 12 hours, that's the bottom of the curve. They had the best mortality. If you waited beyond that, they had increased mortality. So this study suggests that like 12 to 24 hours is the sweet spot. And by the way, most of the deaths that occur in GI bleeds are not from exsanguination. It's from the underlying cause. All right? Now, then they did a couple of other studies basically comparing early, less than 2 to 6 hours, and elective endoscopy. And basically what was interesting is though mortality didn't decrease, they found that in about half of the patients that they did early endoscopy, there was no evidence of ongoing bleeding and they could be discharged. So as far as we're concerned as emergency physicians, if it's available, we will try to actually have those patients, even lower risk patients, get endoscopy because most of them or many of them can then go home as opposed to keeping them overnight, doing it. So you should talk to your endoscopist sometimes during the daytime, they will reserve spots for GI bleeds from the emergency room where they may or may not be able to scope them, and that allows you to send them home fairly quickly. Now, just recently, again, there was a study this year that looked at 13 observational studies with over 1.8 million patients, and they compared early EGD, which was less than 24 hours, to later EGD, and again showed no differences. The last study actually was a randomized clinical trial that was in the New England this year, which randomized 500 patients with high Glasgow Blatchford scores to early within 6 hours or between 6 hours and 24 hours endoscopy, and again showed that there was no reduction in mortality. But the problem with this study is that the 6 hours wasn't from the time of the bleed. It was from the time of the GI consultation. And a lot of the patients were not really sick, and they excluded the patients with shock. So all the patients that we really want GI to come in and see the patient and do endoscopy were not included in this study. So you really have to decide with your endoscopist. At our hospital, generally, if the patient is dying, they will come in. But we'll have to intubate them. We'll have to be giving them resuscitation with blood products. But they will come in for us. But in many cases, they don't. Now, other than endoscopy, certainly you can do other studies like angiography. CT angiography is pretty good for patients who are not candidates for endoscopy or when the source of bleeding can't be found. Other things include technetium studies and capsules. And, you know, I think probably to get back on time, Frank, maybe we'll stop here and I won't talk about variceal bleeding. Are there any, is that good? Is that a good idea?
Yes.
Any questions? Can most of you get your endoscopists to come in emergently in the middle of the night to scope? Yes? Yeah. And a lot of us are using the Blakemore-Sengstetten tube, but in fact, the study suggests that people do fairly poorly. You know, obviously, the patient's bleeding in front of us and we don't have an endoscopist, I would put down the Sengstetten-Blakemore tube. You know, but the data suggests that when you use those tubes, patients do really poorly.